Bears Robert Cain, a Microsoft Office 365 MVP who knows practically everything there is about Office 365. He does stand-up events talking about Office 365. He writes about Office 365 on his blog site, and he does in-person training sessions and training videos about Office 365. There's also me, Mark Keane. I'm the voiceover guy and producer of this podcast. I'm also a Microsoft Azure technical specialist, PowerShell extraordinaire, and IT consultant, helping people move to the Microsoft cloud and consume it by helping them to make sense of it. This is a Need to Know podcast with Robert Crane and Mark Keane. It's all about the Microsoft cloud.
Welcome along to another Need to Know podcast from CIOps. My name is Robert Crane, and on the other side of the mic there, I'm joined by Mark Keane. Mark, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you, Rob.
Well, we've been off the air for a little while, longer than we expected. Obviously, life's got in the way. So what's been keeping you away from the microphone, Mark, of late?
It's a five-letter word, beginning with A.
Ah, dear. I thought it was all automated. You had everything automated. There was nothing you needed to do.
It's not Apple. Azure.
Well, that's good. So why don't we focus maybe this episode on just keeping people up to date with stuff that's happening and what's going on in the Azure and Office 365 world. So why don't you get the ball rolling and tell us some new stuff or some news about Azure?
I guess the big one that was a while ago was the Build conference that happened in San Francisco. That came out probably a couple of weeks ago, which probably most people are up to date with. The other, I guess, big news is the Azure Resource Policy that came out for general availability. Came out sort of in the background, sort of not many people knew that people were working on it in the background. It's actually quite cool because the resource policy in Azure, from what I believe, you can set policies on your subscription. So that means, like, especially in the, say, the resource manager area, with rollbacks to access control, if you give somebody, say, access to a resource group as such, certain access to, say, create new items and add new virtual machines, you can set policies up to say, okay, I want to only allow this person to create a family of virtual machines, not the D class, for example, to save money. So it's a bit of a protection there in Azure. There is actually more to it, but I think it's a very, very good idea. At least you're not going to get like a rude shock on your bill. There's a bit more protection there to stop people spinning up just anything in Azure that's going to cost a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, that's always handy. I think that's one of the big challenges with Azure that people find is obviously firstly, selling it and quoting it. You know, a lot of people are used to getting a single price for an item, and trying to do that with Azure is obviously a bit difficult, but also limiting the amount of funds that are used when it comes to Azure, because what we find is that once a client starts using it, they really, really start liking it, and then they start using it more and more, and they get a bit of a bill shock, I suppose, when they realize the resources that they are potentially accumulating. So I think that'd be a very good add-on, a very good addition for people to go in and have a look at.
Yeah, I'm just looking through here. I mean, you can control things like VM images, for example, the SKU. So you can really lock it down to the type or the version of Windows Server, for example. Or you can even lock it down to, say, just Linux VMs and no Windows VMs, because the Linux VMs are much, much cheaper than Windows for obvious reasons because of the licensing costs. So you can get it down to that level there. Other things here is just looking through, there was an article published. We'll stick it on the show notes, basically.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way to do it. And I think that it's a good indication, obviously, that the additions that Microsoft is adding to Azure, and it has come from obviously a background of developers and resources, and who typically, you know, they don't worry about paying the bills. But now that it's rolling out to more and more customers and more resellers, you need to have that thing to control the billing, because, like I said, it seems to me that once you get onto the platform that you start consuming more and more services. And again, if you're not careful and you don't sort of understand the billing, at least initially, then it can run up to be a fairly extensive bill, especially if you've just on the standard pay-to-go environment.
Actually, speaking of bills, yesterday I had a conversation with one of our customers who did actually get a bill from Azure and couldn't make sense of it. Now, there's two types of bills. There's an invoice you get, which is just an overall invoice of costs for Azure. But also, too, there's a like a usage report, like a CSV file you can download from the tenant or from Azure. Has a massive breakdown. Now, they basically sent it through to us and said, can you make sense of this? Can we go through it bit by item by item? So I opened it up and sorted by meter region, and I guess it's a good time to remind people that from looking at these, the initial reaction I got was, yes, I can understand how scary it is by looking at this bill and all these charges on here, but overall, remember that egress is charged for, that's data going out, and all ingress is free, so that covers every resource in Azure or every service in Azure. That's applies to everything.
Yeah, I think that part of the confusion is that, you know, I mean, the story that I use is you can't go and just buy coffee anymore. You walk into a Starbucks or most upmarket coffee chains these days and you order coffee, they'll just look at you blankly because you need to, you know, long black, short black, cappuccino, what sort of milk, what sort of sweetener do you want? There's so many choices, which is great in one way that you can get an exactly customized offering. But on the other side, that does add the complexity and means that you've got to make the choice. So I think it, obviously the new world that we live in, and again, if you look in the Office 365 space, same sort of deal. You've got, you know, standalone SharePoint, standalone Exchange, but then when you combine them together, you've got a suite. You can have a business suite or an enterprise suite. Then you can add on things like Power BI. You can then add on archiving. So there's lots and lots of options, which is great. That gives you that flexibility to be able to tailor the solution to exactly what you need, but obviously that means a lot more complexity working out, you know, exactly what you need and then exactly how they're built. So certainly can be a challenge for people used to, you know, maybe buying a server or a PC, paying for it, including GST, and then walking out the door. So again, it's just the new world that we live in and just requires a bit of a mental shift, I think, but the benefits are there. We just got to look at understanding how the invoicing is done and make sure you put policies and procedures in place to make sure that doesn't run away with you, much like a mobile phone bill. So we should all be familiar with it because we're doing it with our mobile phones. We just need to do that with computing because now it's just basically become a commodity.
Well, yeah, the good news is the detail is there because, like, look at mobile phones, for example. I mean, data. So I'm relating it back to my wife who used to have a mobile phone bill with a certain provider. And it's one of those certain providers that billed and rounded up to the nearest megabyte, which was crazy. So some of them round up to the nearest kilobyte and some of them round up to the nearest megabyte. So if you went to, say, a very basic website on your phone, which was only, say, 20 kilobytes in size, they'd round up to the nearest megabyte. And then how many megabytes, Rob, in a gigabyte?
Yeah, about 1,000.
But it does sound like a lot. But if you're doing this every single time you go to a website and it's only 20 kilobytes and they round it up to the nearest megabyte, which is 1,024, that's a big roundup. And then all of a sudden she was getting like text messages during the month to say, hey, you're hitting your maximum data limit on your plan, which was 4 gigs, which is quite a bit, enough to cover an average person for the month. But halfway through 15 days of getting the text message, and when I rang them up, I said, look, what's she using it on? And they couldn't provide that detailed information of exactly what was being used. It was just say, it's just internet. And they threw it back to us and say, hey, you just check your apps on the phone and make sure nothing's actually running in the background. And it wasn't until I investigated further that they're rounding up to the nearest megabyte. We swapped over to another provider.
Yeah, I think, again, the reality here is that the detail is there. The detail obviously is not surfaced initially for people. It's obviously made to be as simple as possible. Otherwise, people get overwhelmed by the volume of detail. But it certainly is there, like you said, and you can export it. But again, I think the reality is, like I said, is that with these sort of products, it's very important that you do understand how the billing is and where it begins and where it ends. And that just requires a little bit of extra time and a little bit of knowledge to sit down and do it. But obviously, I think that's where people get put off by the complexity and also a bit scared about, especially when it comes to like something like Azure. And again, it's a case of that they don't really appreciate really what IT resources they are using. So look, I think that that new service is fantastic. It's really good, and I think it'll obviously resonate with a lot of people. They just need to get in and learn how to use it.
Oh, look, it's you mentioned IT resource, but also IT staff. I mean, I'm hearing it every day, like somebody left virtual machines running overnight or for a week and created a massive bill shock. And then they go back and say, well, you got to pay it because you've had it running. But yeah, so I think it'll also put a lot of trust back into Azure and the IT staff, especially for the person that's paying that bill up the top level, knowing that they're not going to get a rude shock at the end of the month.
Well, I think it's like anything nowadays. It's got to a point where you need to manage it very closely, like a mobile phone bill, as you mentioned. And there are benefits if you can sit down and optimize that and work it out. But if you just accept the defaults, then you're likely to obviously not to end up being paying probably more than you want. So again, that's the good thing about, I said, ordering coffee or ordering Azure. If you know exactly what you want and you've got your system, then you are getting, you know, a great value. But if you don't, you just accept the defaults, you could end up with anything. So, you know, if you say you want coffee, you may end up with a cappuccino or you may end up with a long black, where really what you wanted was a short black. So you, I think part of it is again, it's just the new world that we face. It's the consumption-based environment we face, which has now made its way into computing. And it requires a little bit of different thinking, a little bit of a different approach when it comes to understanding the bills and how we pay for these services.
So okay, so this is I'm thinking now, something's just come on in my head. We're comparing, say, Azure, like a public cloud, to say a mobile phone bill, and yes, there's a lot of similarities, and I do agree. I mean, it's like all about consumption, and you get a bill at the end of the month. It's what you use and all that sort of stuff. Now, the other difference between say Azure and a mobile phone bill is mobile phone bills have an unlimited usage. So you pay a little bit more, but you get unlimited use. I mean, I'm just thinking, and I thought about this the other day, there's no reason why Azure couldn't offer. I mean, look, that would be a great idea. I mean, Rob, don't you agree? I mean, putting out, let's say, unlimited usage plans. I mean, obviously they couldn't do it right across the whole board, but they could narrow it down to, say, certain families of virtual machines.
Well, I think also too what we're seeing is, for example, in the remote app effectively is almost gone to like that sort of plan where it has a set, you know, per month cost, and then once you get beyond the usage that it specifies, you can basically then get unlimited access to the service, I believe. So I think we're going to see that. I think that there's probably going to be those two models where you'll be able to, you know, bill per minute. But I think in the long run, as more people do consume Azure, they're probably going to be an unlimited level or a level where you get a fair amount of value before you have to start paying. And perhaps the more common services, like you mentioned, you know, the more common virtual machines may be able to be run effectively forever for a flat rate, whereas the more expensive ones, the ones with more computing power, go to a per cost. But I think the problem is that even that means the whole service won't go to an unlimited plan when it comes to pricing, and that still means there'll be the confusion there. You know, what's unlimited, what's not unlimited, what do I pay for here? I just think it's the way it's moving today, and there are benefits, but again, there are challenges, and people just need to be aware of that and make the most of it. And like I said, you can really optimize your bill as you can with your phone, but again, you've just got to sit down and work it out, or obviously employ someone or go to someone who can help you do that. And again, there are phone companies that will sit there and optimize your bill and work out the best plan for you. So I think it's just the model that we're moving towards when it comes towards consumerization of IT.
So speaking of that, like Office 365 is pretty much doing that now, isn't it, with the subscriptions. You pay, say, whatever cost it is, $5.95 per user per month. You get pretty much unlimited mailbox for Exchange Online, 50 gigs and an unlimited archive with that as well.
Well, I think, again, the complicated thing, again, once again, is there are a number of plans to choose from. Now, Office 365 has become easier to work with because you can now swap between plans. So you can upgrade from a business premium to an E3 to an E5 much easier. But I think the complication is that you and I both know is that users look at it and say, well, you know, we want the cheapest thing and that we want. So a 50 gig email box should be fine. And then, you know, a year later, they're already exceeding 50 gig. And then it's like a case of, okay, what do I do now? What do I need to buy? I think that's where the confusion comes in. And having so many options and again, you've got so many options on so many different products that you get those complications. And again, I think it's just a matter of understanding the product. I think that the reseller, the needs to be more skilled in the offerings, and it makes it complicated because, you know, Microsoft's improving, changing, upgrading these sort of things. But again, I think it's just the world we live in, and we just need to be across that. And it's just the way that companies respond to consumers by giving them lots of choices. But yeah, effectively, what we're seeing is that many of the services in products like Office 365 and Azure are adding more and more value, adding more and more features, adding more and more capacity, and basically keeping the same sort of price. So if you get on the right plan, it's fantastic. But I think just the sheer amount of choice that we've got can be very daunting for a lot of people who, like I said, who are used to, okay, I want to write a single check for a single amount and get so much equipment and not have to worry about it. So again, just a different model.
Yeah, and the other thing to that as well is, speaking of prices, all the licensing schemes that are available. So I work for a company and, excuse me, obviously the licensing team sits on the other side of the fence, so I'm sort of hearing it through my other ear while I'm sort of at work, and sort of it's subconsciously sort of drilled into me the different licensing plans. And the other confusing part is, especially with the enterprise plan, having to commit to a certain amount of money for the next 12 months of spend. And then the downside to that is if you don't use it, you lose it. But the upsell to that and the upside is the fact that you do get a rough 27% discount. Could be less, could be more based on the service you're using across Azure. And the other good thing to that is too, you lock that pricing in for the next 3 years, which they do change that. And I think I remember last time there was a whole massive big uptake of people jumping onto that enterprise licensing plan. They've locked it in for the next 3 years. There was a price increase, I think, about 12 months ago. But these people obviously got in lucky. But that's the other part is trying to sort of predict your bill for a whole company for the next 12 months is very, very difficult indeed.
Well, I think the problem is the difference is that, you know, things change so rapidly. And again, in the environment that we're at the moment, a lot of people are downscaling or reducing their costs. And I think that if you had one complete service that was one bill that encompassed everything, it'd be very hard to obviously optimize that. But the good thing with Office 365 and Azure is, again, you can look at the service you are consuming, you can drill down into the fine grained detail, and you can make adjustments as you need. So in the Office 365 world, you could say, well, okay, maybe I don't need the E3 SKU, I maybe only need a kiosk license for those people who are out in the factory. So that gives you that flexibility, and I think that's fantastic. But the emphasis then falls back on you as the person consuming that to make sure that you're getting the best bang for your buck. I mean, there's plenty of options in there that you can move to, but again, the whole idea is you really need to work out what resources you want to consume, and that's where you have to have that knowledge, or you have to refer to someone who can do that. And that's where, obviously, you know, your licensing teams, the guys you work with, can help. Resellers, you know, in my sort of space can help as well. But again, I think just the sheer amount of choice does make it very daunting for a lot of people who just want to consume. And certainly, a one price covers all would be a fantastic option. But as we know, with things like, you know, OneDrive and other free services, people tend to abuse them over time and use them for the wrong thing just because they're free. So again, there has to be this balance.
So what else is happening in the news, Rob? What have you got on your side?
Very interesting. Woke up this morning and been checking the social media feeds, and Microsoft has come out with this new sort of product called Project Madeira, by the look of it. So M-A-D-E-I-R-A. Very interesting. It looks as though it's sort of a combination of a basic accounting system, tasks to help you run your business. Again, don't know too much about it, but basically it seems to me that, again, it's another little tool that Microsoft's adding into its Office 365 world. You can find it at Madeira, so M-A-D-E-I-R-A. Microsoft.com. Have a look at it. We'll have a bit more. I'll write some articles when I've worked out what it does. But again, something I saw on the Twitter today. So very, very new. First off, hot off the presses here. The other thing that I don't know if you've seen, Mark, is that Microsoft is changing the home screen in Office 365. So when a user logs in, there was a number of icons to click on services, and there was information about downloading Office. They've completely simplified that, and that's rolling out to new tenants now. So again, a bit of a different look and feel. We've also seen a new look and feel in the admin area. So the admin area has been simplified when it comes to Office 365. And to me, it indicates that Microsoft are working very hard on the interface, but they're typically aiming the interface at the power user on premises, the customer's power user rather than a reseller. Resellers probably should be using something like PowerShell. But the other big news is that Microsoft are running an event on the 4th of May called The Future of SharePoint, where they're going to unveil their plans for things like OneDrive and new look and feel, I believe, around SharePoint. So that's going to be very interesting to see what Microsoft have planned, because they have changed or about to change the look and feel of document libraries to make them more like the interface of OneDrive for Business. So
I saw complaints about that.
Yeah, look, I think the thing is if you're a SharePoint person like myself over the years, you're used to a certain look and feel from 2007, 2010, 2013.
Actually, one thing that I noticed with that, which did annoy me, and I couldn't find the replacement, what I was doing when I was sharing stuff out with that sort of stuff, I would share it with somebody and I'd click the option down the bottom, shorten link. You've probably seen that before. And I would always do the shorten link. Always, without fail. But that option, I can't find that anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that was my understanding is that was on the consumer version rather than the Office 365 version. And again, I think Microsoft has, again, changed the interface. I'm sure they'll bring that shortened link back. But you're right, I can't see, especially on the consumer one. I haven't ever seen it, I don't believe, on the business version. But again, it would be nice to have that. The ways around that. But yeah, I agree with you that it would be nice just to have a Bitly or a shortened link to do that. But I think that at the end of the day, it'll be something that they can then add on. It shouldn't be too difficult for them, but they obviously need to get some things out of the way first, get the majority of the changes done before they add those nice-to-have features. So we'll see that, I'm sure.
So other things on the other things on the Azure side, which was noticed mentioned in the Twitter feed, its feed as well, was all about the Azure AD single sign-on, which I guess you're probably thinking, yeah, what's that? I'll just quickly go through. So they've added 17 extra SaaS apps. It just means that it's a big thing. I mean, a lot of people, I guess, don't realize that they've got Azure AD. You've got the ability to do single sign-on on as a service, I guess, or on the platform using Azure. You don't have to set up five servers or four servers on-prem to do single sign-on. You can put all the identities in the cloud and stuff like that. So they're saying that they've added 17 more apps to the single sign-on part, which basically means that you can go in, have your identities in Azure, set up single sign-on to any of these SaaS providers, and I think there's 55,000 they're saying in total now available in the store. And the benefit for that is if you've ever set up single sign-on with a certain app before, you have to put in an issuer URL and a reply URL. So all of this information, setting up the whole single sign-on, they've taken that work out of it completely, all the complexity. They've done that for you in the background. So all you need to do is essentially just go in there, click on the application you want to put single sign-on through to, and it's done pretty much. They've made it so, so easy, and you don't have to worry about running all your ADFS servers on-premises at all. It's all taken care of. So that's, I guess, just to explain what it is, that's sort of good news. It's welcome.
Well, I think the thing is, what we're seeing is, and again, a lot of people don't appreciate you can do this with Office 365 as well. You can create a single sign-on portal for people to access their web apps, which is controlled by Office 365, which is an Azure, obviously, AD login. And that can simplify the process for a lot of these web-based apps. And we're seeing more and more integration where the fact is that the identity piece from a lot of providers is being handed off or is being outsourced to people like Microsoft, who know about AD and security and login, and again, making it easier for people to get access to their web-based apps all through a single login. So as we see local Active Directory on service that people are familiar with, basically controlling security and identity for everything that people access locally, we're seeing that migrate to the cloud with Azure AD. And again, part of it is there's so many features that you can get for free with Office 365, and then you can add on the premium features and then really scale it up. So I think, again, this is another feature of the Azure environment that a lot of people are overlooking the power of it. And I think one of the examples where Microsoft is really streets ahead of most other providers in the way that it can provide an overall identity that manages not only Office 365, CRM, Azure, but also third-party apps as well. So I think it's great.
Oh, it's great. And excuse me. And two, you can add in Microsoft accounts into your directory. You can add in external accounts very, very easily as well, because how many people don't have a Microsoft account? Not many, I'm guessing. And so it's very easy to allow, especially in today's world, access to your internal app securely through people with a Microsoft account. You can control how much access they want, especially with rollback access control. And not only that, the whole single sign-on component, like talking about Azure AD, especially the premium edition, it's the, say, multi-factor authentication that's available now too. And I guess, too, a story I heard, this is interesting, Rob, there was one company I heard that had a policy where they would they change passwords for their users frequently, probably every week. They would write the password down on a piece of paper. That was it. There was no other information for the credential on that piece of paper. It was just the password only. However, it wasn't a basic password, like the word password or something else. It was like probably about 30 characters long of one zeros and or letters and alphanumeric characters. And so it wasn't actually a word as such. So they'd write this down on a piece of paper, give it to the user. The user would put it in their wallet, and that was their password. But then if their wallet got lost, the person that found their wallet wouldn't know exactly what to do with that piece of paper. It was just a different way of helping your users sign in for their workstations and keeping a sort of a control on security from a different approach.
Well, I think at the end of the day, we all know passwords suck, and most users can't use them, and they're complex. And I think Microsoft is at a bit of the forefront in a lot of this technology with things like Windows Hello and Windows 10, the biometrics, the two-factor authentication that you get. Even with default Office 365, you can use two-factor authentication with your phone. A lot of third-party web-based apps now do the same thing, and they have to verify you with a mobile phone. So PayPal, obviously the same deal. It sends you a code, you put it into that. Banks are doing it as well. So complex passwords are exactly that. They're complex, but again, with the two-factor, I think, is one of the saving graces. And I think in the long run, we're going to see some better forms of identification, maybe biometric. But again, with so many passwords, so many things to manage, it can be difficult for users. Anything that makes it simpler is a way to go. My recommendation for most users is LastPass. So LastPass basically has a vault, which it keeps and encrypts, and then uploads that encrypted to a location under LastPass in the cloud, which means you can use those passwords across your different PCs and also your mobile devices. So again, it allows you to generate a complex password, then remember it, and then automatically insert it into the website when you return. So, and they have a free version, so I'd highly recommend people who haven't looked at it and want to manage, you know, the vast range of passwords they're looking at, to look at, you know, something like LastPass to do that. There are other services, but I certainly like LastPass above everything else.
Yeah, it's certainly one of the popular ones. I use KeePass. It seems to be do the same thing. And also, too, I guess it's a good time to remind our listeners that don't forget to turn on two-factor authentication on your Microsoft account. I noticed it's one of the things Troy Hunt says to his audience whenever he gets up and does a speech. He said, look, do me a favor. First thing you do, go to your Microsoft account, go to click on accounts, and turn on, I think it's called two-step, they call it, two-factor authentication.
Yeah, two-step, I think, and they call it two-step, yeah.
Yeah, turn it on, one of the first things you do, because otherwise it's going to make it much, much more secure. So I've done that for pretty much everything I use, my Microsoft account, I use it for my Apple account. A lot of the people support it these days, and definitely make use of it, because a thing in the news yesterday, 1 in 4 Australians have had their identities stolen, and it's cost 17, I think, million or so dollars in lost revenue. So
it's such an easy crime to do, really. Yes. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you know, and I think a lot of people, again, are a bit oblivious to how much digital information is out there on them, and then how easy it is to use that. And again, most people maybe look at their banking and they're worried about their banking details, but in a lot of cases, there are a lot of other systems out there that, you know, people could take advantage of and potentially leverage that against you and use it not only financially, but maybe perhaps to do some sort of, you know, blackmail or ransom or something like that. So, again, unfortunately, in today's age, we do really all need to take more responsibility for our, you know, our security and our privacy, especially now that it moved more and more online. But unfortunately, like I said, we've got this battle with complexity where people want things to be easy. They don't want to have to log in and put a password every time. So there is that delicate balance. But certainly at the end of the day, for me, I'd rather err on the side of the security. But I know that's certainly not the case for most users. And that is a big challenge, and anything we can do to make it easier. But I agree with you. You know, two-factor authentication is really mandatory for everything. And I think the security mantra is, if it's difficult, if it's painful, then it is certainly more secure. So that's the way to look at it.
So the other thing that I noticed yesterday too, that was in the news, they had a reminder about the, you know, the last year in 2015, how the Bureau of Meteorology, the government supercomputer, got hacked into. Did you hear that one?
No.
You didn't hear that one?
No, not yet.
Okay. That was not just recently. That was last year. It was in the media. Yeah, that it got hacked, the supercomputer. And I'm just thinking to myself, like, when I heard that article, I thought, well, okay, so it just goes to show that the government's got their own stuff. It's not necessarily the most secure systems. They can get hacked. Now, let me ask another question. When people are moving to the cloud, who's one of the last people to move to the cloud because they don't trust security?
Well, yeah, it's typically the government. There's no question.
Correct. But yet, they got hacked themselves. So really, I mean, hello. I mean, in that instance, just, I think it just goes to show that, look, for a start, everything can be hacked, I guess.
Anything that involves a human being is obviously insecure, because you've got obviously the insecurity of the code or the way it's been set up, but mm-hmm. you've also got the ingenuity of people on the other side who are looking for the cracks in the system. So I think the thing is, it's what's the ROI? What's the payoff? If there's a lot of money obviously to be made behind it, then yeah, there's more impetus to do it. So look at something like CryptoLocker, which basically downloads a piece of malware, then basically locks up or basically encrypts your files, and you have to pay a ransom to get the key to unencrypt it. So there's huge amounts of money involved in that. So I think that's what people don't appreciate, again, is the finance or the funds or the, you know, people aren't in it to do funny things anymore. They're in it to make money. So that's what we all need to be aware of. And again, we need to be more demanding of our government. We need to be more demanding of our corporations. And how many hacks have there been where people's information is stored in databases that people have been able to download from the internet, that's unencrypted, that doesn't have security policies? Again, some of the basics just aren't being done. And I think that's what really worries me about the Internet of Things. You can imagine everything that you see, touch and hear basically connected to the internet, but all insecure. It's like, oh, I don't know if I really want to live in that world, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, look, I run a startup company myself, and hearing all that information, that those stories, and also the stories of a certain child monitor that got hacked into, I'm thinking, I mean, really? So with my startup, I mean, security comes first, and I seriously mean that. With like SSL security, I've got passwords for different things, the whole basis of just in time admin and just enough admin. Are you familiar with that, Rob?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, I think at the end of the day, the problem with security is that it costs money. And in a lot of cases, consumers aren't willing to pay for additional security. They want to pay the lowest price. And again,
but it's going to cost a lot more money later on in the track once something happens.
No, I agree. But unfortunately, but most people, don't appreciate that, don't see where they need it. And again, the equivalent is maybe like a national defense force. I mean, a lot of people would say, why do we need a standing army, navy, and air force? They're costing us money, they're not doing anything, there's no war, we don't have to worry about it. But obviously, if there's a situation where you need them, we need to have one real fast. But again, it's this balance between, obviously, the defense side of our budget is quite significant, and we have to, as taxpayers, pay for that, even though it's not being used. So in this case, again, the problem with security is if you are secure, you never see it, it does its job, it sits in the background, you don't realize the value it has.
Until it's too late.
Exactly right. So I think that a lot of it is it's a mindset, and until typically people are bitten, especially with identity theft, they won't worry about it or take additional steps. So, for example, one of the things I do is all the mail, the physical mail that I get, or the papers, the documents, I make sure I shred them. And I've certainly endeared that to my family. So my parents definitely now, I bought them a shredder, and they go through and shred all the stuff that they don't want.
And you endeared it to me as well.
Exactly right.
Go to the ATM and get that receipt and just take it home and shred it.
Exactly right. So I think that that's a simple thing you can do, but it is a bit more effort. It means buying a shredder. And a lot of people, unfortunately, don't appreciate that until they've been bitten. So security is always going to be a hard one, and it's always going to mean that a lot of people are unaware, and people who want to take advantage of that can do that in this environment. I mean, you and I, if we go out and we're having breakfast, or we're sitting down, or we're a meeting, or at a conference, I mean, how many people leave their PC unlocked, leave their phone? It is relatively easy for a criminal.
I know a certain somebody who has, iPhones, obviously.
Yep.
You know how you put a PIN number in to unlock them? I know a certain someone who has a PIN number, and it just goes in a certain direction on the screen.
Well,
one direction, because it's so easy to do.
Well, I think I think something like 80% of PIN lock passwords are either the same number, so 44444, or they're exactly a sequence, down,
diagonal,
up,
or whatever. Yeah.
Exactly right. So they're easy to pick. So, but a PIN number shouldn't be your only option. But again, I think we live in an insecure world, and unfortunately, there are people who will take advantage of it. There are people who will make sure they're secure, and it's the same thing with the car. I tell people, is you got two identical cars parked in a shady area of town, the one with the alarm and it's locked and a club lock is less likely to be taken than the same model that has its doors open and the key in the ignition. So,
or just write a letter, or just write a note on the screen, paste it to the inside of the windscreen saying, "Nothing valuable in the car. Do not go."
Yeah, I mean that
try your luck, try your hardest, but there's nothing here.
Yeah, there may not be, may not make any difference, but it doesn't cost you anything to put, I've got one of those in my car, and you might put it in there, it might not stop them, but again, at the end of the day, it's something else you can do for very little cost. So I think that the main thing with security is what are the low end, what are the easy things to do? Two-factor is definitely one of them, decent password, something like LastPass or the tool you use, same sort of deal. So I think there are things people can do, but you and I unfortunately know that most people probably won't do them, which means that people will be out there taking advantage of them.
Look, I guess on the subject of security, I know it's a hot topic with pretty much everybody. I guess it's a good time to remind people too of Office 365 Lockbox. So the Lockbox is a service which they came out with recently in the Microsoft Cloud, and it means that Microsoft support staff cannot get access to people's data or tenants' data in the cloud without getting specific permission, explicit permission from the user or from the admin.
Yeah, well, I think it was sort of initiated to overcome the issue where the concerns of having the government come to Microsoft and issue a secret order for them to turn over their data. The customer lockbox is an add-on or a feature of the E5 SKU, which basically allows the customer to turn a key, and it says that anytime any external party like Microsoft needs to support or access the data, then they need to put in a request to the customer, and the customer then unlocks the data for them. So this means obviously that not even Microsoft can access customer data without the customer knowing. Even if they were served with a secret government order, they would still have to go to the customer and let them know they need access to the data. and that would then alert the customer to that fact. So, and again,
So this all came about because of that whole thing in Dublin, right? The data center where Microsoft were ordered by the court to hand over somebody's data, but they didn't.
Well, I think the thing is, my understanding is that the government in the US, especially the US, has let many, many, many secret orders for Microsoft to turn over, information about individuals. Microsoft is obviously fighting that to say, well, hang on, what's the legitimacy of that? Is this valid? And because a lot of it the government conducts behind closed doors, there isn't that scrutiny. So the easiest way, I think, for Microsoft to protect the rights or the privacy of those customers who really want that is to implement something like this lockbox. So,
and it remove their responsibility. It just takes them out of the picture altogether. It's between the government and the end user where it should be.
Correct. Exactly right. And I think that's the issue. And we saw that with the Apple iPhone and all those sort of things recently that, again, it's one of these balances between the security and also the privacy. That is very difficult to manage. And I think technology companies, like I said, like Microsoft, did the right thing, has stepped out, given users the option. It will be nice to see that across all plans, so all customers have the option of Lockbox. And I believe that maybe in the long run that will happen for all customers. But at the moment, like I said, it's an add-on or part of the E5 license.
See, Apple don't even know the exploit themselves, the security exploit. They don't even know what it is. So they can't even sort of technically plug it, and the government, or what is it, it was the FBI that found it.
Correct.
They paid a security company to a third party security company to find it, and you got to think too, like if Apple did find it and they plugged the hole, then obviously they'd have to find another way in. But somebody's got this information that knows how to get into the iPhone and get all the information out of it.
Well, you and I know that there's probably already lots and lots of people who are doing that, and they're using it for commercial. So they are out there. But I think the important thing here is there's a lot an individual can do by default to protect their data, their information, their devices. You know, they can encrypt their devices at rest. They can have two-factor authentication. They can have decent passwords. They can make sure that, obviously, they keep the devices physically secure. Now, that's not going to prevent it someone attacking or potentially taking the system if they really want it. But on the other side, it certainly reduces the chance of a fly-by attack or a drive-by attack. And again, it's like the patching of computers. You know, the Windows 10 automatic update, I think, is fantastic. And I had a situation where a family member who I'd upgraded to Windows 10, they ended up looking for a legitimate site which had been hacked, and that then tried to inject some malware onto the system. But thanks to Windows 10, it was protected, given that it was always up to date. So again, that's where we typically see issues, where things aren't kept up to date, because there always will be vulnerabilities. And Microsoft moving things like Windows 10 and basically making users ensure they're up to date, I think, is fantastic. But again, my concern is all the stuff that nobody sees, nobody touches, like the Internet of Things and your TV controller, all this stuff which has code in the back of it that really is never updated, is always a concern.
Gotta love the thing that I saw pop up on Windows 10 computer the other day. It was like, if I haven't seen this at all in Windows 10, say, hey, you've got updates to install. Tell me when you want to install them. Give me a choice. Whereas before, what was happening is it was just reboot the computer sometimes by itself. I mean, I've got automatic updates turned off. I've disabled that. But what I've also noticed is if there's an update there waiting to install, even after a certain period of time, it's just going to do it anyway.
Well, I think again, there are issues around that for some people. For some people that like updating because it does break other things. But I think we're fast moving to a world where, everything needs to update automatically. But unfortunately, like I said, this is not going to be the case for every piece of software out there, and that's the concern, because the dice is certainly stacked against you when it comes to security. Because you have to, as a user, protect against every vulnerability. Every single vulnerability you have to protect against, whereas a bad person only needs to find one vulnerability to get in the system, so that the odds are very much against you.
So, Rob, I know we're coming to the sort of near the end here, and I guess it's just to change the subject slightly. I'm in the market for a new computer. I'm thinking a Surface Pro 4 or a Surface Book. We've had this discussion before. You reckon Surface Pro 4 is just as powerful but cheaper? Or should I go down the route in getting a laptop? I do miss the lappability of a laptop. I'm thinking like a Lenovo, possibly.
I think there are a lot of good devices out there. Again, it depends more on the ergonomics, I suggest people. I said, look, I think Surfaces are fine, but again, The keyboards are slightly different. The screens are very high resolution. I think the best thing to do is pop in the Microsoft shop and make sure that you're comfortable with the device. If you're looking at a Lenovo or a Dell or whatever, again, basically go to the shop, get your hands on it, have a look at it, lift and feel it, have a look at the quality and make your decision from there. Because at the end of the day, that's the only differentiation generally with machines is the ergonomics. And again, it depends how you use it. If you plan to sit on the train and want to use it as a laptop, that makes sense you buy a laptop style device. But in my case, it's rare that I use that, so a Surface is more than adequate, and its size, it's convenient, works for me. So I think that it's more about ergonomics than it is about the tech behind it these days.
Yeah, I mean, and the other thing too is I had a going back in the day before Surface came around, I had a certain OEM laptop from one of the major vendors. It wasn't one of the vendors that Microsoft used themselves, but I had, excuse me, I had what's called driver hell, blue screens of death when certain drivers were updated from either Windows Update or from the vendor's driver list or whatever. Then it would be very, very unstable because of the whole driver issues and the firmware and things like that. So the other part to remember too is, if you're going to buy a machine, especially one that Microsoft has in their fleet, I think Lenovo's they have, I've seen them, and Surfaces obviously, because it's all Microsoft, then at least you're going to be fairly safe when it comes to the whole driver part, because obviously Microsoft using them themselves, and they're going to make sure that with Windows updates, you're going to get the decent sort of drivers and firmware sort of mix to make it sort of more stable.
Well, I think the other thing too I've found is, again, if you're looking to be in an ecosystem that is consistent, so a Microsoft ecosystem with Azure, Office 365, it makes sense to go with a Microsoft device. Microsoft also makes sure the experience is pure, means you don't get inverted commas crapware and additional software on your machine, which is bloatware. So again, you've got to install that. So that's why, again, like the Microsoft offering, it just comes with obviously the Windows 10 generally, and again, away it goes. So for me, I'd certainly recommend Surface. I appreciate they are generally a little bit more expensive and maybe not for everybody ergonomically, but I certainly recommend them. I have a number of people who've bought on those recommendations. A couple of family members have them as well. They love them, haven't had any issues. So, again, what I tell people, it's all about ergonomics more than really what the tech is. And my personal preference would be for the Pro, the Surface Pro, because I think it's got more power, it's more flexible, it's smaller, it's lighter. The Surface Book, I think, being a version 1 device, again, I think it's fantastic, but maybe, the next version or whatever, when it comes out, I might look at that. But there's a fair premium that you are paying for that.
Yeah, cool. All right. Thanks, sir. I think that's about it, isn't it?
I think we better wind it all up, let people know. How can people find you if they need any, give you any feedback or comment or ask you any questions?
Twitter is probably the best one. So Mark Keane, that's Mark with a C. I'll just quickly spell it out. It's MarkKean on Twitter.
Okay, so you can find me at DirectorCIA on the Twitter as well. If you've got any feedback, we'll get the information on the show notes for you so you can follow through on that. Remember, don't forget to provide any reviews, feedback, comment. Let us know what you want us to talk about. This has been a bit of a random episode, I suppose. We need to get some people who can give us some topics, look for some guests. So by all means, provide us some feedback, which you can do on the Twitter, and we'll make sure all that happens. But with that, I think we're back to both get on with our day and start working with those cloud technologies and really get them working. What do you say, Mark?
Sounds like a plan.
All right. Thanks very much for listening, everybody, and we'll catch you in the next episode.
You have been listening to the Need to Know podcast from CIA Ops. For training on using technologies like SharePoint Online or Office 365, visit www.ciaopsacademy.com. By purchasing from the selection available, you'll be directly supporting this podcast. To provide feedback on this episode, visit www.ciaops.com/contact. This podcast is voiced and produced by me, Mark Keane.